This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today, we're in Fougères.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And doing stretching exercise, are you there, Lionel?
Mm-hmm.
Or yoga or something. And Daniel Freib.
Hello.
And we've been joined once again, first time this year, but you joined us several times this year, former Doncaster waiter and the doyen of the press room, Francois Thomazeau.
Bonsoir, as we say in French.
Really?
Good evening, yeah.
Thank you, Francois, thank you. Well, we're now back on French soil, so it felt like a good time to invite you back on the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Lionel, where are we?
We're standing in the very hot late afternoon sun in Fougères, outside the worst press room of the race so far. Yeah, or two at
the best buffet. The buffet was great. The buffet is great. You know, where you have pancakes and sausage. That's a Breton specialty, and I found it excellent, to be honest.
It was excellent. We made the rookie mistake of stopping for sandwiches on the auto route, which meant that by the time we got here, I was too full for sausages and pancake, which was a tragedy.
It's a first as well.
Yeah. No, it's too sweltering, like a greenhouse in there.
You boys don't like the heat, do you? You too. You Gaelic chap. Gaelic. Celtic chap.
I just shrugged my shoulders at that. So, listen. Stage seven.
Another Celt. Is it Isle of Man, Celt?
It is Celt, yeah. They are Celt. But there's an uneasy relationship between the Scots and the Isle of Man. They're allowed to shoot Scotsmen if they wear a kilt and stand on the beach. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
Read that in his first autobiography. It might have been made up. Now, stage seven, Mark Cavendish, off the mark. he broke his duck and lots of other sporting cliches. He won. Very relaxed afterwards, as you'd expect. Wasn't the prickly Mark Cavendish that we can see from time to time. And he admitted that in the other two stages that he'd not won, he'd been over-anxious, which is surprising for someone of his experience, but it shows, you know, what is at stake at the Tour de France and the pressure that he's under. Daniel, what did you make of the bunch sprint? Not an awful lot else happened today. Daniel Tekle-Hymenot was on the attack again, consolidated his lead in the King of the Mountains, but Cavendish's win was the headline. What did you make of it?
Yeah, well, we saw how the status quo in sprinting had changed by the fact that Lotto Soudal probably did more work than Etix Quickstep for much of the stage, and the tactic for Etix Quickstep today was really to take a leaf out of more Giant Alpecin actually than Lotto Soudal, that the kind of sprints that Giant Alpecin have been doing for a couple of years now, leave it pretty late by their old standards. Even a few days ago when Tony Martin kind of got to the front at 2.5k to go, that was quite a short sprint, but today was, or short lead out, today was even shorter. We didn't see Matteo Trentin until about a kilometre to go, and then he handed over to Mark Renshaw and Cav, and you know, it was kind of complicated in there. At one stage Greipel could have boxed Cavendish in, he didn't. Cavendish paid tribute to him afterwards, but it was a fairly convincing win in the end. A really gutsy sprint, wasn't it?
He did leave it very, very late. Francois, how popular is Mark Cavendish in France?
I don't know. I think he's very popular with kids, actually, because he has these looks, you know, bratty looks, sort of, and he cried on television, so it's always nice, you know, to see someone cry and blah, blah. If I dared venture, you know, a strange idea, maybe he was better led out this time because Tony Martin is not here. You see what I mean? I mean, usually Etix Quickstep started their sprints from very far, and Tony Martin has been so fast, was probably the faster rider in the bunch, and the way he led out in the last kilometer was probably going too fast and too early, and with almost only Renshaw to lead him out, and it was probably better. And what he said as well is that he realized, and he said it this morning, so they had planned it, that he'd realized that actually Greipel won his sprints from behind, whereas Cav tends to tackle his sprints from the front, and this time he waited a little bit in the backseat and it was probably the right tactic.
Interesting to say about Tony Martin, because he was always a really, really important cog in the HCC High Road machine, but that was a different, it almost feels like a different era. It was far more simple in those days. That team kind of controlled things over the final 10 kilometres without an awful lot of competition, and so a rider like Tony Martin performed a very valuable role. But nowadays, with so many well-drilled sprint trains, you wonder if a Tony Martin type rider is a is an asset.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tony Martin is definitely still an asset. I think the problem positions have been Trentin and, to a certain extent, Kwiatkowski, whose name we struggle with every single evening. They can both be slightly nervous. They've both got a lot of firepower, but certainly when Trentin gets into the wind too quickly, he has tended to panic a bit. He did this on the Champs-Élysées a couple of years ago, and there is a feeling, you know, amongst pundits, experts, that he continues to do that. But today, you know, he came to the front at just the right time, or he sort of led Cavendish out at just the right time, about 900, 800 to go, handed over to Renshaw, and it worked perfectly. So I think that'll be the blueprint for future sprints for Etix Quickstep. The problem for them is that there aren't really any left in this Tour de France. Cav suggested that Valence might be an opportunity, and then, of course, there's the Champs-Élysées, but otherwise, it's slim pickings, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but he got the stage when he said at the start of the Tour that to win one stage of the Tour is a good result. You know, I mean, the problem he's always going to have is that the days of winning five or six, you know, that's the benchmark that he's set himself, and it's not, the Tour route is not the same as in those years when you think of 2008, 2009, and a couple of years after that, there were so many more opportunities, and I think that's something that's got to be taken into account when you look at, you know, everyone's been talking about the drought, and it is almost 2 years since he last won a stage. The last stage win was stage 13 of the 2013 Tour to Sanamon-Montrond. That was the crosswinds day when he got into that little group when Alberto Contador caught out Chris Froome, who was in the yellow jersey that day. But when you look at the stages since, the opportunities Cavendish has had to win, really he's... In 2013, there was only one other sprint. That was on the Champs-Élysées. Marcel Kittel won. Last year, Cavendish crashed out, of course, in Harrogate, so didn't get the chance to sprint there. So really, and this year, beaten in the Netherlands and in Amiens by André Greipel. So it's really only fair to say he's been come up short three times in the 2 years
it's
since
not,
he won.
Yeah, it's not as it's bad a record as you would think when you look at that apparent drought.
Should we talk about the subplot to this win, which we've discussed at length? In previous podcasts, what's been going on at Etix Quickstep, this sort of standoff, Mexican standoff between Patrick Lefebvre, the manager of Etix Quickstep, Simon Bailiff, who's Mark Cavendish's manager. No negotiations had been engaged prior to today. Be interested to see whether phones are ringing this evening. Spoke to Sascha Modolo's agent today, Alex Carrera. Sascha Modolo, the Lamprey sprinter. Patrick Lefebvre approached Alex Carrera at the Giro and said, what sprinters have you got available for next year? I'm looking for sprinters, which obviously sets alarm bells ringing straight away. Modolo, that's not a done deal, Modolo to Etix Quickstep by any stretch of the imagination, but Lefebvre is certainly interested, and there is a rumour that is intensifying that the missing piece in Lefebvre's jigsaw, as far as he's concerned, is Peter Sagan, and he is very interested in signing Peter Sagan from Tinkoff. Sagan is reputedly not happy at Tinkoff Sack, so Tinkoff is not particularly happy with Sagan, so that might be a mutually convenient divorce that might happen. And I've also spied Sagan's manager Giovanni Lombardi talking to Patrick Lefebvre on two occasions in the last couple of days.
Lefebvre obviously wanting to swap all these second and third positions for second and third positions. Now, Daniel, at the end of the stage, you spoke to Ralph Aldag, didn't you, and got the analysis of the stage. Can you tell us, well, you don't have to tell us anything.
The usual forensic, very forensic analysis from Rolf Aldag, the sort of technical director of Etix Quickstep, who in the last few days have been relegated to the third team car, which goes ahead of the race. And this is another source of kind of intrigue and, slight sort of concern on Mark Cavendish's part, because Rolf Aldag is someone he rates very highly. Wilfred Peters, it's fair to say, the Belgian direct sportif who's been in the first team car, is not someone that Mark Cavendish necessarily has rated quite so highly.
So as Daniel says, a forensic assessment. Rolf Aldag also in today's Kilometre Zero episode, which is from the cobbles, and it's fascinating there to hear him talk about that stage before it happened in such detail, knowing even from a spectator's point of view how you could get from section to section. He has an amazing brain. Here's Rolf Aldag.
How much more emotion can you take in this tour? It seems to have been a hell of a roller coaster the first week.
Yeah, but that's always, I think that's always the same. And better roller coaster, if you call it roller coaster, it means you also have a lot of ups. I think there are a lot of teams where you would say like it's more like skydiving. So I think being on a roller coaster, we can pretty much live with that. That's the best outcome in the tour you can hope for. Because, like I say, for many, it's going to be skydiving, and from the start to Paris, it's just down. Well, we knew how fast it would be, and how quick it would go, and how technically tricky it is, and we know how much mess that could create. But we said, okay, you know, we tried it from the front, and if you do it from the front, it has to be a fast sprint, and none of the sprints were fast. And today, we also feel like it's going to be super fast till the 600 meters. It's down, and it's technically, so we have to be present, we have to be positioned right. But from then on, to go from the front, you have a big chance again to fail, and obviously we would not want to take that risk again. And then we just said, okay, Mark Renshaw, he's, you know, just put him on Sagan's wheels, keep him out of trouble, put him on Sagan or Greipel's wheel, and then Kef is fast enough if he comes from the wheel also to accelerate and to get the job done. What you always risk is like if somebody boxes you in, if somebody rides you to the fence, then you know, and you're not going to win it. But today he opened that gap really, really well. You've seen how committed he was when he had to go around the lead-out guy from Katusha. It was super narrow, but he was not hesitating half a second. Like he like kind of like got into Sagan in a fair way, the way sprinters do it. And then the right side was open, and then he showed that he was the fastest.
Follow us on Twitter @cycling_podcast or on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com.
So Chris Froome back in yellow. He wasn't back in yellow today, but he was presented with the yellow jersey after the stage after Tony Martin had to withdraw. He was back in Germany by the time today's stage got underway, I think, or certainly en route there. He was operated on apparently successfully today. So Chris Froome back in yellow. Heard a little bit more about his confrontation with Vincenzo Nibali on the Astana team bus. I'd understood that he had been accompanied by Luke Rowe. In fact, Luke Rowe was dispatched to get him back. Froome. What happened was that Nibali threw a bidon at Chris Froome following the crash, believing it was his fault. There was then some kind of altercation, which apparently ended with Nibali challenging Froome to come to his bus if he was man enough.
Nibali would win that fight every time, wouldn't he? A Sicilian would probably... Well, is that without going down the route of regional stereotypes, a Sicilian probably would fight dirtier than a Kenyan-born Brit.
Well, unless there was a closed-circuit television on the bus, we might not know.
Surely no flick knives involved, though. You know, flick knives would be banned.
I understand there were no flick knives. Anyway, Froome went on the bus. There was a confrontation took place. Words were exchanged. And while they were involved in this confrontation, the replay of the stage was played on the big screen in the bus. And the driver, the Astana bus driver, whose name I've forgotten, but he used to work for British Cycling, weirdly... He drew their attention to this. They watched it. Nibali realised that Froome hadn't actually caused the crash, and apologies were forthcoming. And that was pretty much the end of the fair. But I'd always understood. I always thought Nibali was one of the more popular riders. My sources tell me that's not necessarily the case. Daniel,
I think he's fairly popular. I'm not sure. There've been a lot of confrontations the last few days. There was a confrontation apparently between Peter Sagan's personal soigneur and Alberto Contador's personal soigneur. Tinkoff Saxo have 7 soigneurs at the race, 2 of whom are the respective individual soigneurs of those two riders, and only 2 soigneurs are allowed on the finish line. And I think what Tinkoff Saxo would like to do is send one of their soigneurs who treats everyone, and perhaps Contador's on one day or Sagan's another. However, a turf war has materialised. And then there was also a bit of a turf war in the hotel car park between the Europe Car staff and Team Sky, because Team Sky, I heard today, have 30 vehicles on the tour. Can that be right?
30 vehicles. Well, we're going to their hotel tonight, Lionel, so maybe we'll count.
You have to park here. How far away is it?
maybe we'll count them, shall we? One of them is Dave Brailsford's motorhome, of course. Well, we're hoping to have a look at that.
Francois might have some more.
Francois, any altercations?
There's always a lot of tension between French teams anyway, you know, so there's always confrontation between Cofidis, Europe Car and FDJ. But I didn't hear anything like really nasty, because I mean the French team has been doing so badly so far that you know they have a tendency this year to confront altercations seems to be between themselves and unwittingly, you know, like they fall all over one another. So there's been no time to for real confrontations. I don't know about the Nibali story. My impression is that he's always been super cool, actually, for an Italian, and always treating, you know, people nicely. So I think he was really pissed off. For me, it really the first week of the tour has been so tense that I think that tempers are really boiling by now. And today was a welcome lull. And
any altercations in the press room? Well, maybe keep our antennae. Francois. The story of your time as a waiter in Doncaster, incidentally, for listeners in the dark, that was told in last year's podcast. Francois was a regular last year, hoping he'll be a regular again this year. Francois, we've not spoken much the last few days about Thibaut Pinot, but he's had a pretty torrid first week. What's been your assessment of not so much his bad luck, but more his response to it?
The problem, he said himself, he had a problem with odd years. You know, in 2013, he had a problem. I mean, he was absolutely terrible. His tour was a nightmare. And when you know, he had his latest crash and problem, he came to the bus, and the first thing he said, it's 2013 all over again. So to think that when you're a rider, you know, aiming at a top 10 finish or even a top 5 finish, is already a confession of defeat. You know, like it's hard luck. There's nothing I can do. Like I'm doomed. Fate is involved, and blah blah. The way as well, you know, he pushed his bike away when he had this technical problem. He was actually, you know, more a technical problem than a crash. Proved that he had. I think that the problem with Thibaut Pinot, it was almost remarkable last year that he managed to hold his nerves for the whole of the tour, because he's not nervous like Frenchmen or emotional like you Brits believe French people are. You know, he's not really emotional. He's like from time to time he just seems to drift away from the race and from the intensity of the race. There's always one day or a couple of days in a race when all of a sudden he loses it, and I think that's what happens. You know, he's lost it once, he's lost it twice, and he's lost it.
There was at the stage to Amiens in terrible weather. He had another misfortune there. I think he was caught up in the crash if he didn't actually crash himself, and he was being paced back, and the facial expressions were quite remarkable. It was as though he was playing to the galleries a little bit, you know, demonstrating his suffering, his anguish in a quite a showy fashion.
He seems to have problems with odd years. There have been a few riders, I think, in cycling history who have had the opposite issue. I think Ivan Gotti was certainly a notable one. He had the yellow jersey in 95.
Stephen Roach liked odd exactly. years.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Gotti had the yellow jersey in 95 Tour, won the Giro in 97 and 99.
Yeah, Stephen Roach was remarkable. 81, he won Pioneers Tour Corsica in his debut year. 83, he was up there, and he had a good year in 83. Can't remember specifically why, but he rode well in 83.
85 he was on the podium, in 87 he won
not a bad year in 87.
Yeah, he won the Tour, the Giro and the World Championships, and then but then the thing is that 84 injury hit, I think 86 was terrible, 88 as world champion was awful, and then he had a bit of a resurgence in 89
and he won a stage in 93.
And this year is an odd year, 2015. I've seen him in the village and he looks tremendous.
I was speaking to Tim Harris this morning, who goes riding with him. They look after VIPs. He goes riding with him every day, says he's incredibly strong. He might look a bit big, but he's very strong.
Yeah,
got pistons. He has.
It's an interesting point. I mean, Chris Froome, you know, good in 2013, good again this year. There's something
good in 2012.
He was good in 2012. That's true. Yeah,
that not bad in 2014, no. apart from crashing out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
There goes that. Yeah,
we should introduce numerology to the cycling podcast, you know, every day, you know. That's stats to be fun there.
Yeah. Expect Thibaut Pinot to have a good year again next year.
And now, le pédaleur de charme, supported by British Eurosport.
Okay, it's pédaleur de charme time again, presented by British Eurosport. Daniel, you presented Ivan Basso, the blueberry farmer, with his Pedlar de Charme.
The lighthouse.
The lighthouse, yeah. Did he like it? Did he appreciate it?
He did, but he was totally mystified. He asked me why it was that we'd awarded him. I described it as the premio alla simpatia, like nice, you know, for being a nice guy. And I said, look, I insulted you yesterday and, you know, you probably should have knocked me out and you didn't. So that's why you've got the t-shirt. Right. But he was very keen. I got him on the way to the star, at which point he was about 500 metres from the bus. And I sort of imagined that he wouldn't be terribly interested in keeping the t-shirt, although the t-shirts are very nice. But no, he was adamant that he gave me very elaborate instructions about how to get back to the team bus, who to speak to, where to put it. And so he was very proud of it.
That's nice. The t-shirts are available on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. Go to shop, and lots of t-shirts. They've been doing a roaring trade, actually. Tour is the Tour has been a very popular addition to our collection of t-shirts.
Yeah, that the Tour is a Tour and Pedaleur de Charme have knocked Where Are We Lionel off the top of the chart.
Where Are We Lionel still punching above its not inconsiderable weight. So listen, today we've had a few nominations today. One nomination for Delilah Cavendish, who Pedaleur de Charme.
T-shirts are too large.
T-shirts too large. Baby Grow for Delilah Cavendish, who was going through the mixed zone with her father. She was wrapped around his neck. At one point, she gave a massive big smile and stuck her hand out and did that wavy thing that babies do. And it was Peter Sagan. She recognised Peter Sagan, and they shook hands. And
kids
that was
favorite. Yeah, definitely the kids' favourite.
The kids love Peter Sagan. Well, that was quite a sweet moment, really. She also then, a microphone was being held in her daddy's face. It was a bit too close, and she shoved it away like daughter, like father. Yeah. So, and Cavendish acknowledged that she took after her father.
Just another digression on Cavendish. I think we mentioned before, Cavendish is very good friends with the MotoGP rider Cal Crutchlow. Now, I witnessed a very lively discussion between those two a couple of months ago, in which Cal suggested that he would probably, you know, have, he might be able to hold his own in the pro peloton, to which Cavendish he sniffed loudly and said, no, you'd be a second rate pro, you'd never ever win a race, you'd be useless. And well, I've just had a message from Cal Crutchlow. He says, please explain to the other press that you know a motorcycle rider that would have won three stages by now. Ha!
Oh dear. Well, listen, a lot of nominations for Mark Cavendish, some nominations for Peter Sagan, some for Andrew Greipel for not closing the door on Cavendish. Cavendish acknowledged that he had sprinted like a gentleman. He said he could have closed the door on him. He didn't. That was gentlemanly and charming. Who do we give it to? We have to choose somebody.
Who do you think?
Cavendish. Will you give it to Cavendish?
Greipel for the gentlemanly.
Do we have any big enough t-shirts for Greipel?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Well, we've got some. Yeah, we should have just brought smalls for these skinny pro bike riders. We're keeping the small ones for the mountains. Mm. We've been getting rid of some medium ones. I think Greipel's probably a medium. Yeah.
I think the key there was that it was a noticeable move, and if had Greipel chosen to block Cavendish off, Cavendish wouldn't have won the stage. And I think that indicates this kind of respect between the equals in the sprinting ranks. You know, Cavendish has often in the past got frustrated by people he doesn't feel should perhaps be right at the front end sprinting, people who perhaps don't know those little etiquette things that you...
Etiquette's quick set.
The etiquette, you know, the being able to think clearly enough in those circumstances not to stitch up a rival.
Maybe you could give it to Chris Froome, because he had the elegance to just obey the rules and not wear the yellow jersey today.
Although apparently they were told that that there would be no yellow jersey awarded anyway today.
No, so. He couldn't. This way he could sound and look like the nice guy, because I mean the rules were on his side. So in any case, there was no choice. But he still tweeted this morning that in case you want to know, I won't be wearing it. But he knew from last night that in any case he couldn't wear it. So.
Be like me tweeting that I'm not going to accept the Journalist of the Tour award.
Really?
If such a thing existed.
Did Chris Froome, by the rules, was he not able to wear it because, strictly speaking, he wasn't the leader of the race until the peloton had got past kilometre zero? Is that correct?
Kilometre zero, Daniel. That's a good mention of our morning show, kilometre zero, every morning. That could be true, but the whatever the actual rules, the president of the jury told Team Sky this morning that there would be no yellow jersey awarded. That could be the reason.
The problem is there's confusing precedent that for both cases. I mean, in the women's tour recently, people were pointing out on Twitter that when Lizzie Armitstead crashed out after the finish line, the following day Lisa Brennauer was made to wear the yellow jersey. Not made to wear the yellow jersey, but wore the yellow jersey on the insistence of the organisers. And in a case with a race like that, it's much probably more important for them to have the yellow jersey and the sponsors of the yellow jersey on show. Whereas at the Tour, you know, the Tour is so big, it's not quite as imperative.
The Tour is really simple, actually. Since Tony Martin finished the last stage, he's still topping the GC the next day. So and Chris Froome was still second, so the guy who is second can't wear the yellow jersey. It's pretty simple.
Simples. So we're starting to look ahead to the team time trial. We've got an interesting stage tomorrow. It might finally suit Peter Sagan.
We've been sent out on loan to another podcast tonight, haven't we?
Daniel and Francois.
One maybe on the team time trial, yeah. Because I just talked to Nicolas Porter, who says, with Quickstep out of it, well, not out of it, but Tony Martin out of it, with Orica Greenwich, you know, only six of them and one injured, Nicolas Porter said, maybe that's our year, and we have a fair chance, Team Sky, of winning it. I just wanted to.
Okay, Francois. Well, you are off to your team partner a nightly French podcast this year, Francois. Is that because of the talent you showed for podcasting last year on the Tour with us?
It's because of the talent you show every day, and we were convinced that we should try to emulate this in French. You know, the French we tend to take everything English and try to make it our own.
As our little podcast, the first accredited podcast at the Tour de France we were last year, has our little podcast inspired a French version?
Yeah, well, you know, there's, I don't know if there's a rivalry between us, but it might be, you know, no, it's not. I mean, you know, I suggested to the guys, because it's, you know, it takes time to do two podcasts, that we might at some stage do a sort of Entente Cordiale podcast and mix both together, you know.
The French and the Scots have always mixed very well, the old alliance. I'm not so sure about the French and the English. I don't know if you guys could be involved in that.
I'll tell you, when the tour next comes to England, we'll do a podcast right in the centre of the Channel Tunnel. From one end, we'll walk from the other, and we'll meet in the middle.
Pod in the middle.
Very good idea, yeah.
All right, Francois and Daniel, we better let you go. Daniel, we'll see you again tomorrow night. Francois, I hope we see you sometime in the next week.
Anytime you want.
Thank you.
Cheers, boys.
Goodbye.
So, team time trialling then on Sunday. It's unusual, isn't it, to have the team time trial so late in the race on the ninth day. Normally, it's the sort of thing they do on the third or fourth day. I gather the tour organisers had to get a kind of dispensation from the UCI in order to schedule it that late. We'll hear from Matt White of Orica Greenedge and also Luke Durbridge of Orica Greenedge. They won the team time trial in 2013 in Nice and put Simon Gerrans in yellow that day, I think, if I remember rightly. Would have been probably the favourites. It was certainly the stage they were targeting. They've had an awful first week in terms of luck. Losing three riders already, and Michael Matthews, I mean, I saw him yesterday morning and he was making a real groaning noise and wincing as he just get on and off his bike, and he really is only battling through so he can just be a body in a team time trial, I gather, on Sunday. So they're kind of out of the picture. Interesting that Matt White, reluctant to, you know, to lament their bad luck. The tour is a tour, to use our well-worn cliche. Everyone knew that it would be on the ninth day. It's just the way the luck has fallen. But it is remarkable that Trek have lost Fabian Cancellara, Etix Quickstep have lost Tony Martin, Orica Greenedge are in all sorts of trouble. Lotto Soudal, although not a favourite for the team time trial, they're really struggling. They lost Greg Henderson today. Adam Hansen is riding with tape holding his collarbone together, more or less, and just battling through the days. And it's going to make the race a battle of survival for a number of the teams. And some strong teams that you would have expected to challenge for the stage win are really going to be doing little more than trying to just get through the day. And Francois says they're Sky among the favourites. It does look like it's going to be the four will be sort of Astana, Sky, BMC and perhaps Tinkoff Saxo.
Well, it's interesting because a lot will depend on how those teams are shaping up. They've all come through this first week relatively unscathed. Michele Scarpone at Astana is apparently unwell. He's had a sickness bug. He was up a lot last night, unwell. But generally speaking, they're all okay. I noticed the Sky riders lost a bit of time today, quite a few of them. Luke Rowe, Peter Kennick, Wout Poels, Richie Porte. You wonder if they're starting to think about Sunday and taking things a little bit easy. We'll see. But anyway, let's hear now from Matt White and Luke Durbridge.
Matt, can I ask you about the technical implications of starting the team time trial with fewer guys?
Well, it's just harder. We've got a lot less horsepower than we originally planned. Daryl Limpey's South African time trial champion, and Michael Albertine is a very robust rider who was in our winning team. Well, all three of them were in our winning team from 2 years ago. So it's for sure it's a big loss. But technically, yeah, I guess you come to the front a little bit quicker.
Yeah, everyone will have a bit more work to do, won't they? Because and you can't, I guess you can't really protect anyone in the same way that you might do. You can't use any guys up early.
No, we'll be approaching it different. But look, realistically, the team's time trial is going to be a very hard target for us to achieve what we want to achieve with six riders.
A couple of years ago, obviously, you won the team time trial here. That was a really well plotted out effort, wasn't it? You used your riders early on and lost them, but that was all part of the plan. So
100%.
So now you have to sit down and do you have to ride it a bit more conventionally, just keep everyone together? Because if you lose, go down to five, suddenly you're in trouble.
100%. We've got to get the guys through the team's time trial. Our focus won't be winning the team's time trial, because we want to carry those guys all the way to Paris.
So I don't want to heap any more bad luck on you, but if you were to lose another rider between now and Sunday, or what are the implications in terms of can you start come what may? Even if a team was down to four riders, you still get the start?
As far as I'm aware, yes, you are.
Right.
And I'm sure that the UCI would make could make allowances after the first week of the Tour de France, that no matter how many riders any team have, they could start the team's time trial. They want everyone to finish. There'll be no non-starts from any teams, no matter what happens.
I was overhearing you talking to some other journalists. You're definitely not playing up the bad luck aspect. That's part of the Tour de France, part of Grand Tour racing.
It is, and I don't think there's too many teams who've got through this unscathed. We bore the brunt of it a little bit harder than others. That's all there is to it.
And in terms of the decision of putting the team time trial on the ninth day, no complaints, just the way the race... You knew since October this was going to be how it's going to be.
Yeah, that we prepared for it. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to work out, when you look at the course from Holland through across the north of France, it had the potential for the perfect storm. Mm. It eventuated.
Yeah.
And that was the course and also the weather conditions. And look, we got better weather today, and I don't think it'll be as stressful, but it always had the potential to work out as it is.
Now, lastly, I think everyone has watched, or a lot of people have watched, the footage from your mechanic from the terrible crash the other day. It really brought home to me what those crashes are like. I think when we watch on TV, it's almost sanitized. You don't.
Yeah.
The thing that shocked me most was the moaning from riders who are injured and the kind of dazed look. You must see that, and you've been part of that as a professional. Do you think it's good that the public are getting to see those kind of insights?
I do. I think all the extra shots we're getting from the bike and off the mechanics, it's actually giving a much broader look at what's going on behind the scenes and actually in the race. You know, one thing's watching the race on television, but to see the stress those mechanics go under, and in our case with the mechanic, how cool he was and how he got the job done, looking after the riders, looking after the bikes, it's an incredible insight to actually what these guys are doing day in, day out.
And do you think the public are becoming, you know, perhaps a little bit less blasé about what the riders do? Because Simon Yates came down, I gather he cracked his helmet, picks himself up, finishes eighth on the Mer de Huy.
Yeah. It just shows how tough a lot of these athletes are. But I go back to saying, these guys have worked incredibly hard to get here to the Tour de France. No one wants to give up. This is the biggest race in the world. They're going to try their darnest to get whatever result to finish. It's the biggest race in the world, and no one wants to give up.
Luke, I know it's a few days away, but looking ahead at the team time trial, how much more of a challenge is it going to be to have the team reduced to six as it stands at the moment?
Realistically, I think it's not a big objective for us now. You know, like, you can't miss three guys and have one guy with broken ribs and realistically expect to compete against a team of nine strong, you know. So, yeah, for us it's not necessarily a major target anymore. We're going to go and have a go, but we'll have to wait and see.
From a technical point of view, I mean, it increases the workload on each rider simply because of the mass, doesn't it? You've got 28 kilometres, you've only got six instead of nine.
Yep.
I mean, do you have to set out with a completely different mindset?
Yeah, sure. Longer turns. I guess a small group, you know, you can, you're going to have to look after a lot of guys, and also to the finish, you know, 55 guys, so that makes it also quite tricky. So, yeah, we're just going to have to look after each other a little bit more, and, but I think it's definitely something that we can... yeah, put in the back of our mind, give it a go on the day, but we'll have to wait and see.
I don't want to tempt fate or look on the negative side, but if you were to lose another guy before the team time trial, even two riders, what are the implications in the rules?
I think you know just as much as me, mate. I have no idea. I don't think they've had anything like that in Tour de France before, so we'll have to wait and see.
You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Fried.
So we heard there from Matt White and Luke Durbridge. That's about it for us from us tonight, Lionel.
It is, yeah. We've got a top secret appointment we need to get to now.
So might have hinted at what that was earlier.
Yeah, well, let's hope that all comes off and we don't have to edit that little mention out.
No, we won't. Anyway, so that's all from us tonight. We'll be back tomorrow night. No Kilometre Zero Saturday or Sunday. That's Monday to Friday, Kilometre Zero in the morning. Today, you can go back and find all those are there. They might not appear in the right order if you're in a podcast app. There's been some issues with that, but they are all there. They're on our website and on Audio Boom as well. A reminder that you can become a friend of the Cycling Podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Become a friend for £5 and that will gain you access for the whole year to our friends specials. There are five up there. We're expecting to put some more stuff behind our paywall in the next week, so sign up if you feel like becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast. And that's all from us tonight. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for listening.
For the best analysis, discussions and interviews from the 2015 Tour de France, listen to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.